Bring the Books by Mr. Charles Terpstra, Review Editor. By Faith Alone, Answering the Challenges to the Doctrine of Justification, edited by Gary L. W. Johnson and Guy P. Waters, foreword by David F. Wells. Wheaton, Illinois, Crossway 2006. Pages, 213 pages, $17.99 for paperback. Reviewed by David J. Inglesma. There is something to be said for this book. It is a defense of justification by faith alone against the denial of this cardinal truth by the New Perspective on PAW, or NPP, and by the Federal Vision, FV. The book contends that justification in Romans refers to one's legal standing before God the Judge, rather than to one's inclusion among the covenant people of God, as N.T. Wright wrongly argues. Justification is the imputation of righteousness, not the divine declaration concerning God's covenant faithfulness. Justification is not only forgiveness of sins, it is also the imputation to the believing sinner of the act of obedience of Jesus Christ in the elect believer's stead. The contribution by C. Fitzsimon Allison, several different authors contribute various essays related to the subject of the book's title, is delightful and perceptive. Allison observes that denial of imputation is possible today in ostensibly conservative Reformed and Presbyterian circles, inasmuch as we live in a climate bereft of biblical awe of God's justice, transcendence, and awesomeness. Page 110. The book does not hesitate to name names or to skewer the enemies of the truth of righteousness by faith alone. In his essay, Reflection on Auburn Theology, that is, the Theology of Christian Reconstruction and the Federal Vision, T. David Gordon suggests that Pastor Stephen Schlissel embodies the best and worst of Auburn Theology, that is, the Federal Vision. A great bombastic provocateur, who may be temperamentally unsuited to be a theologian, page 114. Schlissel is the independent who was long the darling of the conservative Christian Reformed ministers and members, and whose theology the men of the United Reformed Churches have never forthrightly denounced and repudiated, although shrewd self-interest has moved them to distance themselves from bombastic provocateur Schlissel in public after using him. Of special interest to the Protestant Reformed reader is the article by Professor John Bolt of the Christian Reformed, a Christian Reformed theologian at Calvin Theological Seminary. Bolt's article is titled, Why the Covenant of Works is a Necessary Doctrine, Revisiting the Objections to a Venerable Reformed Doctrine, pages 171 through 189. Bolt re-examines the covenant with Adam in Paradise in light of the denial by the men of the Federal Vision and others that the covenant was a covenant of works. In this re-examination of the nature of the covenant with Adam, Bolt considers Herman Hooksma's rejection of the doctrine of that covenant as the doctrine was current in his Christian Reformed circles in his day. Although judging Hooksma to be wrong about covenant conditionality, which covenant conditionality Hooksma denied, on page 186. Bolt is appreciative of much of Hooksma's explanation of the Adamic covenant. Hooksma is right about the relational dimension of the Adamic covenant, he writes. Hooksma's theological instincts are right on target here and reflect some of the profoundest conviction and insights in the Reformed theological and confessional tradition, page 186. The conclusion of Bolt's article is commendation of Hooksma's understanding of the covenant with Adam. We read, Hooksma's brief and cryptic comments in his discussion on the covenant with Adam in creation carry all the more weight. For Hooksma, the covenant relation is not incidental, a means to an end, but rather a fundamental relationship in which Adam stood to God by virtue of his creation. It was a relation of living fellowship and friendship. From the very first moment of his existence, Adam stood in that covenant relation to God and was conscious of that living fellowship and friendship which is essential to that relationship. As God's covenant friend and representative, office bearer in all creation, Adam was given a task as God's co-worker for which his reward was the Sabbath, like pure delight of it in the favor of God. Pages 108 and 189. Having quoted Hoeksma's declaration that all Scripture presents the covenant relation as fundamental and essential, there can be no doubt that Adam, in the state of integrity, stood in covenant relation to God. Bolt concludes his piece with a hearty, "Yes, indeed." Page 189. In light of this approval of Hoeksma's conception of the covenant with Adam, Bolt, despite his disavowal of Hoeksma's repudiation of a conditional covenant with Adam, cannot possibly find himself in agreement with the doctrine that posits that covenant as a conditional contract proposed by God and accepted by Adam sometime after Adam's creation, which was the doctrine of a conditional covenant that Hoeksma was rejecting. There is, however, also something to be said against this book. It is the defense of justification by faith alone against the denial of this cardinal truth by the NPP and the FV. By the present time, some 14 years after Norman Shepherd's public proclamation of the theology of the Federal Vision and Reform Circles by his publication of the book The Call of Grace, How the Covenant Illuminates Salvation and Evangelism, it ought to be abundantly evident to every Reformed Christian, much more to every Reformed theologian, that such a defense of justification by faith alone against the frontal attack of the Reformed faith by the Federal Vision is both desperately inadequate and grievously wrong. The engine of the FV assault on the heart and core of the Reformed faith, which is the gospel of grace of Holy Scripture, is the FV's doctrine of the covenant as a gracious but conditional relationship with all baptized persons, especially all baptized babies of believing parents alike. The issue in the life and death struggle of Reformed Orthodoxy with the theology of the Federal Vision is the Federal Vision's doctrine of a universal, gracious, saving, but conditional covenant of grace in Jesus Christ. I note that conditional covenant of grace is an oxymoron. The advocates of the FV thus openly advertise their teaching, see Shepherd's The Call of Grace. The name of the theology betrays the covenantal essence of the theology. Federal means covenant. Justification in the covenant by faith and by works is only the implication of the more basic false doctrine of a conditional covenant of grace. The source and force of the heresy of the Federal Vision is the conditional covenant of saving grace, which covenant is deliberately, openly, and thoroughly cut loose from the eternal decree of election, the sole source and foundation of all salvation that is gracious, that is, of the only salvation there is. As long as the self-proclaimed adversaries of the Federal Vision and self-proclaimed defenders of the Reformed faith in its hour of crisis, and this is the hour of its crisis, dance around the issue of the unconditionality or conditionality of the covenant of saving grace, the Federal Vision remains firmly embedded in the Reformed churches and will, like every fatal disease that is tolerated in the body, eventually destroy the confession of the truth of salvation by sovereign grace alone. Thus, the Federal Vision will destroy the Reformed and Presbyterian churches that tolerate the doctrine of a conditional covenant as energetically spread by the Federal Vision. Second, against the book is that it engages in dialogue with the Federal Vision and the MPP. The dialogue is argumentative, but it is mere dialogue. All the contributors to the book respond to the advocates of the Federal Vision and of the MPP as though these heretics were legitimate disputants in the Church. They are not. The Reformed creeds clearly confess justification by faith alone. Just as clearly and sharply, they condemn the theology of justification by works as heresy, as a teaching officially condemned by and banned from all Reformed churches. Reformed men must not, indeed may not, perpetually debate the proponents of the Federal Vision and of the NPP. Whether justification is by faith alone or by faith and works, whether the meaning of Romans and Galatians is the doctrine of salvation, soteriology, or a doctrine of membership in the church, ecclesiology, are not debatable matters in a Reformed church. These issues have been decided. The creeds plainly confess the decisions on these matters. Theologians must not, indeed may not, debate the heretics within their churches. The churches must discipline the heretics, and then as heretics of the first water, men who deny the gospel of grace at its heart, and who are introducing the false gospel of Rome, Arminius and Pelagius, into the churches of the Reformation. A book against the federal vision surfacing in a Reformed church must be very brief indeed, only one line. The doctrine of justification by works is condemned by the Reformed creeds, and I, therefore, charge you, the author, preacher, or lecturer, advocating the federal vision, before your consistory with a public sin of heresy. Not one of the contributors to By Faith Alone appeals to the Reformed confessions. For example, Lord's Day 23 and 24 of the Heidelberg Catechism. Not one calls for, much less announces, the discipline of the heretics in the Reformed churches. Cornelis P. Venema explicitly notes that N.T. Wright's NPP rejects as an encumbrance the traditional formulations and confessional positions of the 16th century Reformation. Page 34. Venema then calmly proceeds to debate Wright, rather than condemn the popular, influential heretic as contradicting the Reformed creeds, including the 39 Articles of the Church of England, see Articles 11 and 12, and as violating his commitment to uphold his churches and all the Reformation's confessions. The impression is left that the controversy with the Federal Vision and the NPP is merely an interesting, largely amiable theological discussion, which enables learned theologians to put their theological acumen on display, and publishing companies to sell one book after another. Indeed, the churches of most of the contributors to the volume have distinguished themselves either by producing the heretics or by exonerating the leading teachers of the federal vision at their ecclesiastical assemblies or by harboring and protecting them within their fellowship. R. Albert Moeller, Jr. is mistaken when, in his afterword, reflecting on the content of the book, he lauds the book as an arsenal of theological arguments in defense of the gospel, page 207. The only theological weapon that will destroy the federal vision and thus defend the gospel against its attack is missing: proclamation of sovereign, efficacious, particular grace in the covenant. In addition, the book's arsenal of weapons does not include the imperious call to exercise Christian discipline against the heretics. Where discipline is not exercised, heresy inevitably wins the day, and the churches. Where discipline is not exercised, theologians and churches alike show that they do not take the issue, which is the truth of the gospel, seriously. An arsenal, lacking the only two weapons that will defeat the foe and safeguard the kingdom, leaves something to be desired. By Faith Alone is, therefore, doomed in the churches of the defenders of this fundamental truth. The very last word in the book itself is the dreadful warning. In light, not so much of the false doctrine of the federal vision and of the NPP, as of the fatal weaknesses of the defenders of the truth, that Luther rightly described as the article of a standing or falling church, the warning, which the writer intended only as a warning against a possibility, in fact, announces a certainty. Quote, "Nothing genuinely evangelical will remain of evangelicalism," unquote. Page 208. That is, nothing of the genuine gospel will remain of that which claims to be the preaching and confessing of the gospel.